Our contributing producer and guest host is Kevin Pina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. And our associate producer is Aliyah Sharif. Miguel Gavilan Molina is our roving producer. Be sure to look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows, or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio and the Star Theater are proud to present a special pre-Burning Man mid-tempo dance party and double album release at the Star Theater Thursday, August 21st. For Halo Refuser, it's the release of his full-length album, Into Your Layers. And for Gouda, it's the release of his Tyromancy EP. Also performing, Ninja Monk, Takimba of the Melting Pot Radio Show, with live musicians and fusion belly dance from Bridgetown Review. That's Thursday, August 21st at the Star Theater. For more information, go to the right side of the KBOO webpage under events.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale coming soon, and we are accepting donations now. The sale will be held sometime this fall. The book and record sale is a great way to help contribute to your community. So do us and yourself a favor. Clear out those books, comics, DVDs, VHS tapes, LPs, and CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is a little after, it's 11:03 a.m., and coming up is the incomparable Radio Zine with Sojourner Truth Radio from sister station KPFK in Los Angeles. So let's listen in.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, protests on the streets, and the military-style police response brings to light decades of racial hostility. And now, yet another unarmed young black man is killed on the streets of Los Angeles. What's going on? Our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn, who was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. And the U.S.-backed campaign to discredit Haiti's largest political party, Lavalas, is heating up as an arrest warrant has been served for the head of the Lavalas party, former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, on what is widely seen as trumped-up charges. Journalist Kevin Pina fills us in. And for our weekly Earth Watch, blockaders take direct action to stop the flow of tar sands and fracked oil. Rachel Avery, arrested at the Dam Line 9 site, joins us. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandiri. Heavily militarized police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson fired rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas at crowds out in the streets again last night to protest the police shooting death of unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown. Police rolled out in armored trucks. At least 10 people were arrested last night, including St. Louis Alderman Antonio French.
I'm very discouraged. This was supposed to be a peaceful rally, that we wanted peace and unity. We don't want an adversary relationship with the police. We want to partner with them to find out what happened and to bring justice for Mike Brown, because that's what it's all about. And so the fact that it had to come to this is very disheartening and disappointing.
Two reporters from the Washington Post and the Huffington Post were detained by police while working at a McDonald's in the area. They were later released. Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson told reporters earlier in the day that the St. Louis County investigation of the shooting could take weeks to complete. In the meantime, he said his department welcomes Justice Department training on racial relations in the suburb. Two-thirds of the 21,000 residents are Black. All but three of the police force's 53 officers are white. The White House said President Obama was briefed on the situation last night by Attorney General Eric Holder and Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett. Family members of a Los Angeles man shot and killed by police this week say Ezell Ford, who's African-American, was unarmed and lying on the ground when police shot him three times in the back. Authorities say they were responding to a reported officer-involved shooting and were conducting investigative stops. When they stopped Ford, and a struggle ensued. Ford's family say he was mentally ill. They're filing a federal civil rights lawsuit against the LAPD. A new five-day truce between Israel and Hamas appeared to be holding today despite a shaky start after both sides agreed to give Egyptian-brokered peace negotiations in Cairo more time. The Israeli military said fighters in Gaza breached the truce by firing 8 rockets at Israel shortly after midnight. Israel said its fighter jets attacked targets in Gaza. No casualties were reported and hostilities died down by dawn. The second extension of the ceasefire, this time for 5 days, has raised hopes that a longer-term resolution to the conflict can be found. A senior Hamas official who returned to Gaza from the talks in Cairo said they'd been tough, but expressed optimism, saying there was a real chance to clinch an agreement. Members of the Palestinian delegation said they would return to Cairo for more talks on Sunday after consultations with Palestinian leaders in the West Bank. Palestinian negotiator Azam Ahmed.
In the final moments, or the final minutes, it was agreed to extend the ceasefire for 5 more days. It'll begin at midnight tonight and it will end on Monday. Instead of 72 hours, it's 120 hours. The Palestinian delegation will leave for Ramallah tomorrow morning for consultations with President Abu Mazen and with the Palestinian leadership.
Palestinians are demanding an end to the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza. Israel's security cabinet was scheduled to meet later in the day to discuss the proposals. Egyptian and Palestinian sources said Israel tentatively has agreed to relax restrictions on the movement of people and goods across the border, subject to certain conditions. Clashes between Iraqi troops and Sunni militants west of Baghdad killed at least 4 children today. The latest casualties come as the United Nations announced its highest level 3 emergency in the wake of the onslaught by the Islamic State fighters. UN officials say at least 10 militants also died. Since their blitz offensive began in June, fighters from the Al-Qaeda breakaway group have overrun much of northern and western Iraq and driven out hundreds of thousands from their homes. Kurdish forces are requesting more artillery, and France says it will deliver. California Governor Jerry Brown has signed legislation to put a $7.5 billion water bond before voters in November. He acted soon after lawmakers approved a compromise plan last night. The governor and lawmakers were finally able to clear their main hurdle, a disagreement about how much money should be spent on dams and reservoirs. Assembly Republican leader Connie Conway said Republicans held out and won $2.7 billion for what are referred to as water storage projects. That's more than a third of the total bond measure. Her remarks were emailed to reporters.
So to start at $2 billion was not acceptable. I understand the governor's need to be thrifty. And then the negotiations went to $2.5 billion. But to settle on $2.7 billion, we feel like that is real money that can address immediately, start some projects.
Environmental groups had argued money for reservoirs and dams would do nothing to address California's severe drought. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And for our weekly Earth Watch, we're going to welcome Rachel Avery. She was arrested at the Dam Line 9 site. She was acting as a liaison between police and those locked down, and they were protesting the passage of tar sands as well as fracked oil from Sarnia to Montreal in Canada. Rachel Avery, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so Rachel Avery, tell us what your protest was about. What was behind it?
So Line 9 is an almost 40-year-old pipeline that Enbridge has running from so-called Sarnia to Montreal, Ontario through Quebec. And it had been transporting lighter, like conventional crude oil, and they've proposed to reverse the flow to make it go west to east and pump tar sands, bitumen, and fracked oil from the Bakken Shale through it. So this is a proposal that facilitates tar sands expansion and fracking expansion and further endangers every watershed, every ecosystem along the route of Line 9 because of the increased dangers posed by these substances, particularly the diluted bitumen, which we know from Kalamazoo, Michigan, if it spills into a river, it sinks to the bottom. We don't know how to clean it up and releases all of the chemical slurry of the diluent used to make it flow through the line that causes health problems to the surrounding communities. So the Dam Line 9 blockade was a work stoppage, a blockade of a work site on Line 9 that stopped work from Tuesday through Sunday.
Right. And also joining us is Dan Keller, who is the media spokesperson for the Dam Line 9 protest. Dan, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Okay, so Dan, you know, tell us then about the impact and effectiveness of the protests. What kind of public response are you getting?
Sure. We've actually got a lot of really positive public response to our work stoppage. This has been one in a series of actions that have been taking place over the last several months around the Line 9 pipeline. We've got a lot of good positive media. Some of the media that has some of the mainstream media that has been ignoring this issue has started to pick it up, and we received a lot of support on the site from local community members came by and talked to us. So yeah, it's been really good experience so far with this blockade that was unfortunately raided. But we have been really getting some good outreach with it.
Right. And, you know, Dan, oftentimes activists get frustrated. They say, well, we protest, we, you know, do everything by the book. Certainly in the United States around the Keystone XL pipeline, still not resolved. Hundreds of people were arrested, a lot of civil disobedience going on. Nevertheless, it seems as though the oil, people who are making money from the oil, including tar sands, always seem to have a leg up. We also know that the First Nations, particularly in Canada, have been playing such a central role, including bringing the whole information about the threat of tar sands first to the world. I think it was Native American people in Canada who did that. So what do you say to people who become jaded, you know, about these kinds of protests? Dan Keller.
Sure. I think the the movement is just building. You know, we have had a few arrests with this, but these are direct actions that people are taking. We set up, you know, a week-long blockade, and people came out over the week and joined the blockade and learned more about the issues. This is just it's a building movement. I don't think people are jaded with the direct action segment that has come on since the more so-called legal processes happened through the National Energy Board process. This is part of it's part of a diversity of tactics that are going on, right from people going to, you know, taking it to court, people taking going to the National Energy Board and presenting evidence against Line 9, and people, you know, people marching in the streets and people taking direct action at work sites. It's really seeing a really good diversity and a good mix of people. However, we haven't had a lot of support from the larger environmental organizations more recently, and that has been some issue has been raised around that, of course, as they're fighting pipelines in other areas. They're fighting the Keystone XL, they're fighting the Northern Gateway in BC or the Energy East in Ontario. But there's not a lot going on in terms of the larger organizations and fighting Line 9, whereas it's a pipeline that's going to facilitate the expansion of the tar sands and the Bakken shale fields.
Right. And Dan Callow, I mean, what you are describing with kind of grassroots actions and that don't get the support of the larger non-governmental organizations in the environmental movement is a story that I'm hearing again and again, not only in the environmental movement, but in every movement. And Rachel Avery, your thoughts on where things are now with this movement?
I think what we've seen, especially over the last few weeks and months, is growing opposition to Line 9, people more inclined to take direct action. We've seen a number of occupations of work sites. We've had one-day, two-day, week-long occupations where people have stopped work and have been successful in slowing Enbridge down significantly, and they're really feeling the impact of this. I mean, they've, from their end, increased their security. They now have better trained security guards on all the sites where there are previously no security, so they're feeling the opposition. They also have been hiring PR people because we know that, you know, they don't win in the battle of facts. We know how risky Line 9 is, and all they can do is add PR.
Yeah.
We've also seen growing interest in supporting the legal challenges and Enbridge having to respond to issues of consultation. And that's another big thing that's happening within resistance to Line 9 is that Indigenous communities who have not been consulted are continuing to insist that that's necessary for any project to occur. So Chippewas of the Thames, which is located near the area that we were blockading earlier in Inarkip, they have a challenge, an appeal to the NEB decision because of the lack of consultation.
Right. Yeah. Now, Dan Keller, we are going to have to wrap it up. For people listening to us, an audience in the United States who may be saying, well, that's going on over in Canada. What does that have to do with us? What does that have to do with the movement in the United States against tar sands, including the Keystone XL pipeline? Dan Keller, final thoughts.
All these pipelines are connected. We need to be shutting down and focusing on all of the pipelines, the Keystone XL, the Alberta Clipper, the Northern Gateway, Energy East, you know, any of the other ones, Line 61 that's going down through Wisconsin, Line 6 in Kalamazoo. They're all connected, they're all similarly dangerous to our communities, and they all allow for the expansion of tar sands and the shale fields. And we know that's just not an acceptable thing to do in terms of climate justice and environmental justice. So we need to all be stepping up and stopping, you know, working on stopping all the pipelines that will stop the tar sands from expanding.
Right. And Dan, is there an email address that people can go to get more information about your campaign?
Sure. There's damline9.tumblr.com was for the last action. Our group locally here in Waterloo has the Waterloo Region Coalition Against Line 9, noline9wr.ca.
Right. Okay. Well, we want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project, our partners for our weekly Earth Watch, and Rachel Avery and Dan Keller, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now we turn our attention yet again to Haiti. Since the successful Haitian Revolution that led to the ending of slavery in the Americas, the U.S. and former colonial powers have undermined freedom and democracy in Haiti. And the people in Haiti say that they are still working to complete their revolution. Haiti is now a source of cheap labor and sweatshops for multinational corporations, including Levi's and Disney. Haiti also is now the most impoverished country in the Western Hemisphere. Now, at one time, Haiti was considered the jewel of the colonial holdings of France. It was rich in natural resources, and it still is today. The U.S. and other Western powers, since the Haitian Revolution, have backed what is referred to as Haiti's permanent government. The elite mulattoes, dictators, former military intelligence and bureaucratic establishment people who do their bidding, drug lords, and more. Also, following the Haitian Revolution, the United States refused to recognize the new republic and threatened Haiti 26 times with military ships in its port. It was said to, quote unquote, protect U.S. business interests. The United States invaded Haiti in 1915 and stayed in 1934. So they occupied that country for 19 years. During that time, U.S. Marines took $500,000 from Haiti's National Bank and deposited into what is now Citibank. We don't know how much that would be in today's dollars. There have been 13 coups in Haiti, including two U.S.-backed coups against Haiti's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a wildly popular former liberation theology priest. Haiti was also devastated in the earthquake that left hundreds of thousands killed and millions either injured or displaced living in temporary camps. And most recently, Haiti has been devastated with a cholera epidemic that was brought to Haiti by UN troops. UN troops are now the occupying force within Haiti. Since the last coup in 2004, U.S.-backed interests have floated the idea of bringing criminal charges against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who, despite so many efforts and coups, remains wildly popular with Haiti's poor, who are the vast majority of Haitians. And now an arrest warrant has been issued for him. To fill us in on what is going on, we'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth journalist Kevin Pina. Kevin, thank you for joining us. Well, Kevin, when you think it just won't get any worse or ridiculous, it absolutely does. Now, the story that I have heard is that it was reported in the press that a summons was going to be issued for President Aristide to appear in court. But the president's lawyers have said that that summons was never, they never received it, and neither did the president. What have you heard? I mean, and what is the situation now with this summons?
Well, you know, this is largely being, you say, reported in the press. So where this is originating from is actually from a new sort of news outlet that's been created by the former State Secretary of Communication for the current Martelly government. That's a man named Guy Delva, who used to write for Reuters. He created a new online news service called the Haiti Caribbean News Network, or the Haiti CNN.
Uh-huh.
And that's where a lot of this is originating and then being picked up and resonated through other outlets in the media. But it's pretty clear that it's coming from one source. Guy Delva is very close to Haiti's Justice Minister, Renel Sanon. He's been putting documents out on the web showing that Aristide has been barred from leaving the country. And he could only get those documents by having close access to the Martelly government. He was on CNN this morning, and he's being seen as a credible journalist when, in fact, he still holds credentials as an official advisor to the Martelly government, who's now posing basically as a journalist, putting out, who's largely propagating a lot of this from inside of Haiti itself. You're absolutely right. I just got off the phone about 10 minutes ago with Aristide's attorney, Ira Kurzban, who said that this is basically a sham and yet another in a series of a revolving door of charges against Jean-Bertrand Aristide. There are no substance to this. This is about prosecuting Aristide in the court of world public opinion. This is about making good people believe bad things about Aristide. That's what this is really about, and it's about the press. There was no subpoena served. In fact, the judge who's behind this so-called corruption probe is himself barred from practicing law. Now, remember, this judge who's who's actually behind all of this inside of Haiti, named Lamar Belazaire, is a Martelly appointee to the court. He has actually been barred from practicing law by Haiti's Bar Association for 10 years once he leaves that post for misconduct. So it's very interesting that, you know, he's being used now, knowing that once he leaves his post as a judge, he can't practice law in Haiti for 10 years. He's being used by the Martelly government now on his way out of the door to bring once again what Aristide's attorney considers to be false charges. Once again, this is meant to hurt his reputation, Aristide's reputation. This is not anything serious, although people in Haiti are taking it serious. I understand there was an all-night vigil in front of Aristide's house. The road in front of his house in Tabar has been completely blocked with hundreds of people who've been there all night. There were reports yesterday that there was an actually five police cars that went to his residence to try to arrest him. Those were rumors. That was not true, according to Aristide's attorney.
Right. And Kevin Pina, you know, you have lived in Haiti for quite some time with family there. I've traveled there myself a couple of times. And it is very, very clear that whatever since 2004 and even before 2004, that President Aristide remains extremely popular with Haiti's impoverished people. They really see him as one of them, as speaking for them. And there have been so many machinations and plots and misinformation, including trying to stir up trouble within Lavalas itself to challenge the leadership of President Aristide. But he has pretty much remained pretty cool and calm throughout this. So it does seem as though this could be yet another attempt to, in a way, get rid of President Aristide when all other attempts before have failed. Kevin Pina.
Well, I don't think it's going to succeed. I mean, they've tried to, I mean, going all the way back to 2005 after, well, we'll go all the way back to 1990. In 1993, when Brian Littell of the CIA got in front of the U.S. Senate and claimed that Aristide was on drugs, was on lithium, and had been hospitalized in a Canadian mental institution. This was after Aristide was overthrown in the first coup in 1991, and the CIA was trying to keep him from going back to Haiti. They began a series of what are now well-known lies against Aristide to try something very similar back then to assassinate his character. We know that in 2005, after the second coup, that the coup government claimed that there were issues with embezzlement. We know that that was picked up and repeated by the Miami Herald and other news outlets internationally. There was never any substance to the embezzlement or corruption charges that were leveled by the coup government that was backed by the United Nations, put in power by the United States after the coup in 2004, in February 2004 against Aristide. And then, of course, in 2005, we've got Joseph Contreras of Newsweek writing that Aristide was about to be indicted for drug trafficking, which never turned out to be true. So we've seen this regular litany. Again, what what's referred to as a revolving door of charges against Aristide, against his character. And you point out rightly, the real reason is because of his popularity. And why his popularity is such a threat today, of course, is because of the possibility of there being free and fair elections in Haiti. Ira Kurzban, Aristide's attorney, wanted to emphasize that with me this morning, saying that what this is really about is every time there are any serious moves towards real elections in Haiti, now they will pull out any kinds of charges against Aristide. Let's also remember that last January, another Haitian judge had said that based upon the testimony of Oriel Jean, who was a former head of security under Aristide, who was indicted for drug trafficking and charged with drug trafficking by the department, by Miami grand jury, and then was cut a deal by the Department of Justice for basically telling lies against Aristide, his sentence was reduced, was cut in half by the Department of Justice, then made the allegation that Aristide had given the order to former Senator, Lavalas Senator Milan Liberus, for assassinating Haiti's most famous journalist, John Dominique. That was just last January. Of course, that was dropped because there was never any teeth to that. There was nothing, anything real about that. So we didn't hear anything about that until, of course, this subpoena summons, which was reportedly issued by this this discredited judge on Monday. And, of course, Milan Liberus was among those who were named also as being subpoenaed by the court and having arrest warrants issued for her as well. She's now in Miami. She, of course, denies all of these charges. Again, this is a put up. This is this is nothing new. All you've got to do is do a little bit of research and you'll see. And you also see that there's a lot of black ops going on against Aristide today. Go to a website called therichest.com and look up Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and you'll see this ridiculous assertion that he's worth $800 million. And if you see how they calculate what he's worth, you'll see that it's clearly a put up. That this has been planned in advance, that people have been seeing this on the internet. And I don't know what else to say about it, Margaret.
Yeah, well, Kevin, what we're going to do now is we're going to play a short clip about this prison escape, the prison break that happened a few days ago in Haiti.
An armed gang has attacked Haiti's main prison, releasing an unknown number of the jail's 899 inmates. Two police officers were hit by bullets in the assault, whose main target appears to have been Clifford Brandt, a businessman who's been facing charges since 2012 of kidnapping two children.
Okay, so Kevin Pina, that's a clip, by the way, from Euronews. The reason I'm even playing this clip and wanting to bring this up, the latest, of course, is that this Clifford Brand, the wealthy businessman whose family, he owns a car dealership and his family has extensive business holdings in Haiti, and he is a friend, it is reported, of Martin Lee. And for people, our audience who may not know, Martin Lee has ties to the former dictator, Baby Doc Duvalier, who's the Tonton Macoute and the people who terrorized Haiti for so long, and they were thrown out by the people of Haiti. And this, of course, led to the bringing in and the election of President Aristide. Now, Baby Doc Duvalier is now back in Haiti. And some of the shenanigans seem to be starting up again. But the reason for this is that there is some concern that this guy was captured, but there's still over 300 of these prisoners on the loose, some of whom are out for revenge. And it coincides, this was a well-organized escape, it coincides with all of this press and whatnot about President Aristide having to appear in court and being arrested. So there's worry on the part of some people that they may be trying to create a perfect storm that may end up bringing some harm to the president. Kevin Pina, your thoughts on this prison escape and any connection?
I assume you mean the former president.
The former president, right. I keep referring to him as the president, right? I mean Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Well, just a little bit of background. Clifford Brandt is one of Haiti's wealthiest families. Back in 2005 and 2006, you remember that there were many raids by the United Nations on poor neighborhoods like Cité Soleil, and one of the reasons that they possibly went in there and slaughtered, by the way, civilians, women and children, was because they said that they were breaking up kidnapping rings. and they were accusing members who were associated with the Aristides Lavalas party of having run these kidnapping rings. Well, it turns out that one of Haiti's wealthiest families was, in fact, behind those kidnapping rings, and it was not those members of Lavalas in those poor communities like Cité Soleil and Bel Air, as the UN had said. And one of the people behind those accusations, of course, was Andy Aped, the sweatshop owner who was behind Aristide's ouster in an organization called the Group 184. But, when Clifford Brunt was caught after this escape, it was a daring daylight escape where commandos basically went into what's called a maximum security prison in an area called Croix de Bouquet. I've been in that prison, and this is paid for by Canadian millions of dollars of the Canadian government. A seat of the Canadian International Development Agency built that prison, a maximum security prison. This was a commando raid during the daylight hours to get this guy out. So there was collusion with the police inside of the prison, although there were two guards who apparently were shot, but none of the commandos were captured. Clifford Brunt escaped. And by the way, when he was caught on the Dominican border, he was caught with an actual identification, identifying him as an official advisor of President Michel Martelly. That has been mentioned as among his IDs that he presented at the border when he tried to cross out of Haiti after this daring daylight escape from Haiti's maximum security prison in Croix de Bouquet. Whether or not it's being used to cover up what's going on against Aristide, no one can say. I think it's pretty much falling off the press at this point. And what we're going to see now is, with Guy Delva, again, the former state secretary of communication for Martelly, who's posing now as a journalist in order to continue these allegations against Aristide, being on CNN this morning, I think we're going to see this full court press in the press by Delva. We're going to see it repeated by other news organizations, as it has been in the past, despite the fact that, according to everyone who's given any sort of real legal stand, who has any real legal standing, there is no basis, there are no merits, in fact, for these charges against Aristide.
Right, and of course, there is the thought that probably occurring to the U.S. State Department, one would hope, because we know that these moves against President Aristide really wouldn't be happening without the blessing, of the United States and the U.S. State Department, that any move against President Aristide could cause major problems and major disruption because people are not going to have it, so to speak. So we'll watch this story as it develops. And Kevin Pina, thank you for yet again joining us. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
We are going to take our station break, and coming up, the St. Louis, the Ferguson police shooting, the murder of Michael Brown, the shooting also of Ezell Ford in Los Angeles. And this is the anniversary week of the Watts riots, known also as the Watts Rebellion. Dr. Gerald Horn joins us. We'll be right back.
This is Gloria Steinem.
This is Joni Mitchell.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
Beautiful brother of mine, whatever may be your birth sign, we are not of the same seed, although we are both the same breed. Together we're truly black. Power, learning to trust by the hour.
Alrighty, so that was beautiful brother of mine, the artist Curtis Mayfield. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Michael Brown, an 18-year-old black teenager on his way to college, was shot and killed by a police officer in broad daylight in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri, on Saturday, August 9th. Michael Brown put his hands in the air to show he was unarmed and cooperative before the police shot him several times, according to eyewitnesses. This incident, with its heavy media coverage, has spurred outrage among the public. The people of Ferguson have expressed their anger on the street, clashing with police for five straight nights. Additionally, protests have followed the murder of Michael Brown in nearby counties such as Clayton, where several hundred people marched through downtown and descended on the county prosecutor's office. Policemen with dogs and AR-15 assault rifles have used tear gas against protesters, peaceful and otherwise. And indeed, you have vehicles that look almost like tanks with a police military garb on top of them with rifles pointed at protesters. There have been calls for the FBI to lead an investigation of Michael Brown's murder. A state senator, Jamila Rashid, has requested an investigation from the U.S. Justice Department. The family of Michael Brown, they have taken on Benjamin Crump, the lawyer who provided legal counsel to the family of Trayvon Martin. The public, particularly the black community, are infuriated with the lack of critical attention given to police brutality, racial profiling, and the regularity of innocent young black men dying in what is now considered a drawn-out massacre. Four unarmed black men have been killed by police in the last month alone. Eric Garner in New York City, John Crawford in Ohio, Michael Brown in Missouri, and Ezell Ford just recently in Los Angeles. Ford, a 25-year-old resident of the Florence neighborhood in South LA, was shot to death by LAPD officers on Monday night. The LAPD claims that he was attempting to seize one of the officers' weapons. However, eyewitnesses say that Ford was complying with police and gave no struggle. The incident has drawn strong parallels to Michael Brown's killing in Missouri. And here to discuss all of this with us, including the fact that the police in Ferguson are refusing to identify the police officer or even say how many times Michael Brown was shot, but also to put it in some context, we're glad to welcome back Dr. Gerald Horn, who happened to be born and raised right near this where this incident happened, well, actually in St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Horn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course, Dr. Horn holds the Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States, and his newest, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Dr. Horn, we're going to start out with this report from CNN.
You said to me that a few minutes ago that people can protest peacefully, but there will be no looting tonight.
That's correct. And, you know, protesting peacefully, you know, that's fine. We're fine with that. But what the people have done now is we've asked them to move multiple times, and we're trying to disperse the crowds out of the area. The reason that tear gas has been deployed on a couple of occasions is those crowds are not dispersing. Not only are they not dispersing, they're throwing bottles, coins, rocks at the police.
And this is a lot of young people reacting to getting shot at with tear gas, being met at with riot gear. You know, how else is these young kids gonna react, man? We being met with aggressiveness.
There is such a vast contrast between what we're experiencing now and what I experienced just a few hours ago at a church in Normandy, about 2 miles from here, where about 600 people came together. They wanted to come together as a community to pray together, to ask for justice together. And there was speaker after speaker imploring that there not be any violence.
Martin Luther King did not live and die that we might steal in the name of justice in the middle of the night. He lived and died that we might seek justice in the middle of the day.
What Brooks was saying was you shouldn't be looting in the middle of the night. You shouldn't be burning the businesses in your neighborhood. It takes true courage. It takes true courage to seek justice peacefully, nonviolently. And that's what his message was tonight. That's what everybody's message was at the church. But of course, at least in some instances here in Ferguson, they didn't hear that message.
Yeah, well, Dr. Horn, you know, you see on MSNBC and others, that was the voice of the civil rights leader talking about people not burning stuff down, but Al Sharpton and the rest of them descending on Ferguson, having a lot of photo ops and telling these young people who clearly feel threatened and are outraged that they should calm down. And that really seems to be very much the role these days of civil rights leaders to come in and calm things down, and then not much happens. But Dr. Horn, your response to that and also some context, you know the area well.
Well, I would hope that civil rights leaders would be more concerned about the snuffing out of innocent human life than the destruction of private property. As you suggest correctly, I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm quite familiar with that area. St. Louis has the reputation of being one of the most segregated cities in these United States of America. I remember growing up in St. Louis, and the highlight in the black community of St. Louis would be something called the Veiled Prophet Parade. This is when local Euro-American elites would dress up in what appeared to be Klan uniforms and march through the black community on a regular basis. I'm not sure if that Veiled Prophet Parade still takes place. In any case, I think we need to recognize that the civil rights leadership, in any case, is in a morally tenuous position because it's very difficult for the leadership to be quiet, for example, the Israeli outrages in Gaza and inflicting violence there, and expect support when violence is inflicted upon our people in places like Ferguson, Missouri. Not only that, you made reference to what you saw as tanks in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. And this reflects the fact that since September 11, 2001, there's been this enormous military buildup in the United States. A lot of the Pentagon surplus has been donated to local police departments, which now not only have tanks, but drones and night goggles and assault weapons and all of the rest. And it's inevitable that that kind of military materiel will be turned against the civilian population of the United States. And it's very difficult for the civil rights leadership to, on the one hand, be quiet about this Pentagon military materiel being turned against people in Palestine, and yet seeking to raise outrages about it when it's turned against the people of Ferguson, Missouri.
Yeah, and there's a editorial by Charles Blow in the New York Times today, in which he says that the black male dropout rates high school are more than 1.5 times those of white males. And Dr. Horn, you have talked certainly about the criminalization of black children, right? And he also said that black Missourians were 66% more likely in 2013 to be stopped by police, and that blacks and Hispanics were both more likely to be searched, even though the likelihood of finding contraband was higher among whites. So you have a largely black population, the police, you know, largely white. And then you have this, as you say, history of racial tension that goes way back to before Michael Brown. But and Dr. Horn, also this within the context, I mean, just Monday night, the killing of another unarmed black man here in South L.A. and the choking death, you know, in New York City. Dr. Horn.
Well, this is all taking place in the context of a deteriorating U.S. economy, with anxiety rising, not least amongst the many in the white working class who thickly populate the police department in Ferguson, Missouri. We have to recognize, however, that this harassment of black men, in particular, that Charles Blow talks about in the New York Times, is a cross-class phenomenon. Keep in mind that in the New York City in which Charles Blow lives, the New York State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, just negotiated an agreement with Barney's, an upscale Manhattan clothing store, which caters to affluent black American men shoppers, they were harassing their very shoppers. And you might wonder, well, why would a store harass shoppers? Isn't that going contrary to the principle of profit? But there are other principles besides profit, and I think that that's what we need to recognize. That is to say, keeping a subject population in its place oftentimes takes precedence over the basic factor of human greed.
Right. What, Dr. Horn, what we're going to do is open our phone lines now and hear from some of our listeners. You will stay with us. We want to hear your thoughts on what you think is going on. And meanwhile, let's Dr. Horn, as we're waiting for calls to come in, let's hear from a clip from the Wall Street Journal on the violence that is happening in Ferguson. Two journalists have been arrested. The police were firing tear gas last night. It's like a war zone. Or is there a war going on against us of a certain melanin color here in this country? Let's hear that clip right now.
Violence continued for a fourth night on Wednesday in Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting of an unarmed 18-year-old late Saturday. Protesters threw Molotov cocktails and fireworks at riot police, who responded with tear gas and rubber bullets. The situation escalated after police told protesters to go home after nightfall. The protest began after unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot dead by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. The shooting has increased racial tension between the predominantly African-American residents and the mainly white police force. President Barack Obama on Tuesday urged reflection and understanding. According to Associated Press, Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson said, "Unfortunately, an undertow of racial unrest has bubbled to the surface. Race relations is the top priority right now." He went on to say that the investigation of the shooting could take weeks to complete.
Weeks to complete. I mean, give me a break. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Let's hear from Ron. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm beginning to feel like I'm in the movie Groundhog Day. I keep seeing this happen repeatedly, not just recently. We have a situation in Compton recently where L.A. County Sheriff abused a young black man, a shooting recently in Los Angeles that resulted in the death of a young black man in New York. You can extend this out to Donald Sterling. There seems to be a virulent type of racism directed at black men in this country, and this country will do everything but deal with that. I would like to say, finally, that I'd like to remind people that the word police is a derivative of the word policy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ron. And John, you're on the air. John on line three.
Thank you. I'm just so sick and tired of it all. I think it's time for us to do what the Palestinians are doing and bring in the International Criminal Court to look at the genocide against black people in this country, because from selling crack cocaine, from the things that have been found in the Church Committee hearing where it said the FBI's number one purpose was to prevent a black messiah, there's just too many things that are going on here that against our people that we have to bring other people in to help identify everything. We need to look at Michelle Alexander's book. We need to put everything down. We need to write down every crime that's happened against us. And we need to present it to the International Criminal Court, because this is just ridiculous.
Let's go to RK. RK on line nine. RK, you're on the air.
Good morning, sister. Good morning, brother.
Good morning.
Someone who's experienced being lynched almost in 1960, my whole family, when I was 9 years old. Okay, because my uncle didn't say sir, and when he didn't say sir, the police pulled a gun out and said, "I'll kill all you jiggers right now. Don't you know I'll kill you now?" And so I experienced that. Then I also was beaten in 1989 by the police out here in California and set on a sensitivity training situation in a town I lived in Upland, California, and found out then that the police don't care. You know, they just had to be there. Okay,
yeah.
We're losing 7,000 black folk a year still to homicide. And I believe I heard either on your show or the other sister that comes on before you, that there was 312 justifiable homicides in the black community in 2012. If that's the case, there was 400 justifiable homicides overall by police, by the WBPD, Waistband Police Department, in 2012.
Right,
that
okay.
That means most of them were us. It's not going to change. It's getting worse. The numbers used to be 12,000 a year homicides in the black community. It's just clearly genocide.
Okay, RK, thank you for your thoughts. We're trying to fit in as many people as we can here. Tony on line one. Thank you for waiting, Tony. You're on the air.
No problem. I heard, if this is correct, that over the city where the young African-American gentleman was murdered, that the police and the authorities put up a no-fly zone.
Yes, they did.
Right. Uh-huh. Here's the reason why I'm laughing. It's ridiculous. But I think it's very, very well thought out by the ruling powers that they know that this is the Watts Week of Memorial Commemoration. They don't want that to be shown and the connection, and there could be mass rebellion. So it's a psyop situation.
And shut down the rebellion and send some civil rights leaders to tell people to go home also.
That's my point.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Let's go to Eric. Eric on line two.
I wanted to point out that a few weeks ago I heard on this station that 1 in 10 deaths in L.A. was at the hands of an LAPD officer. I wanted to point out that that's decimating a population, and it's an age-old tactic to keep a population down and subdued. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And let's get, Morris on line four. Then we do want some final thoughts from Dr. Horn.
How you doing, Ms. Prescott?
I'm okay. How you feel?
I'm fine. I had two things. A question for your host that about the Moors.
Yeah, Dr. Horn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he would speak on Noble Drew Ali. And my question for you, Prescott, that if you can ever look into the dictionary that's called the Black's Law Dictionary and look up the definition of black, it's a dictionary that's used in the courts of law.
Okay.
By ourselves black. That's the position that we put us here in this nation. And when you call yourself black, you have no standing in law. So that's why we need to be careful about using that word. We need to claim a nationality and not a color as a nationality.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons that we don't have standing in the law that are more than what some of us call ourselves. But thank you for your thoughts, and we certainly will look that up. And Dr. Horn, some final comments from you.
Well, the caller who suggested a claim in international criminal court is spot on. Certainly the ICC or the Organization of American States, which happens to be headquartered in Washington, need to be queried and need to send investigators into St. Louis sooner rather than later. Unfortunately, because of our civil rights leadership breaking ties with progressive international humanity, that becomes difficult. Secondly, reforms. That is to say, not only a Justice Department investigation, but also reforms in terms of how these police officers are trained. They're oftentimes trained to be like occupying Marines when they should be trained to be like social workers.
Yeah, and, Dr. Horn, for all of the leaders that are running around saying, well, people just need to go home. I mean, I'm a nonviolent person and certainly wouldn't be promoting that on the airwaves. But there seems to be a lack of understanding of a kind of rage that happens when you have been beat down again and again. And the other thing also is that for people who go out and write the letters and march up and down, as people did with Trayvon Martin, there's still no justice for Trayvon. So the example, if they want folks not to be going out in the street and tearing stuff up, it might be that they should listen and take action when people do things, quote unquote, the way they say we're supposed to do them. Dr. Horn?
Well, you have a point there, and I think the overriding consideration we need to keep in mind is that obviously we need more organizations. We need more well-defined organizations that are willing to go into places like Ferguson, Missouri, and organize people to bring claims against the police department and take claims to the International Criminal Court if need be.
Yeah, and also the kind of militaristic response. You know, you see videos now of Al Jazeera and CNN and other reporters basically fleeing in Ferguson. These are white folks fleeing from the police in Ferguson, being shot at with tear gas, you know, and more. And one would hope that that would bring, you know, some better understanding of not only what's going on in Ferguson, but in places like Benton Harbor, Michigan, and across this country where folks are catching hell. Just a final thought, Dr. Horn.
Well, I'd really like to point listeners to an article in USA Today which deals with this question of well-armed police departments taking Pentagon surplus and how we're going to be the ultimate victim of that kind of policy.
Absolutely. And please continue this discussion with us on Facebook. We'd love to get your thoughts on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. We are out of time today. Show produced by Margaret Prescott. Thanks to the Sojourner Truth team, Marielle Roski, Sherelle Withers, our engineer, Teddy Robinson, assistant producer, Kevin Walker. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. In your heart and soul.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Portland Hawthorne Hostel's 11th annual Bike-In Movie on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. The film will be True Fans, an award-winning documentary about an epic cross-country bicycle journey of three men traveling to the Basketball Hall of Fame and discovering the real America along the way. Musical entertainment will be provided by Train River, an eclectic collection of bluegrass and string band musicians. Again, that's the 11th annual Bike In Movie showing of True Fans on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it's 1 minute after 12 here at KBOO in Portland.